Right now, a Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is underway in Washington as Christine Blasey Ford offers reluctant testimony about Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, who she says assaulted her when they were in high school. Shortly after the story went public, President Trump tweeted that if the attack had taken place as the accuser claimed, her parents would have reported it back then. That statement has prompted people all over the country to come forward and share stories of sexual violence, along with explanations for why they didn't report it, under the hashtag #WhyIDidn'tReport. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're having what might be a challenging conversation for many of our listeners about the factors that keep people quiet when they've been assaulted. Call 816-235-2888 if you have a story you think people should hear about why you did or didn't report and how you feel about that decision. And just a note, if you need to take a break from this conversation, we totally get that, and we'll be switching gears probably at around 10:35. So let me introduce our first guest. She's a therapist and writer who lives in Lawrence, Susan Krause. Good morning.
Good morning.
You wrote a novel called Insufficient Evidence about the interface of rape, alcohol, Title IX, the uphill battle of prosecution, and trial by social media. It's based on your experience as a therapist in a college town, and it was supposed to come out next month, but your publishers made a push to get it out this week because of the uncanny resonance with the news. Is that right?
Yes, that's pretty accurate. It's been a very crazy 48 hours. And I can't say, but I believe right now that it's up on Amazon, and I think Kindle will be up today. And
that's pretty crazy.
It is crazy. And at the same time, it's been a long time coming. I mean, I've been doing this work for 40 years. Not much has changed.
When you say not much has changed, what is it that has not changed?
Well, I'm just saying in terms of some of the issues in terms of women rape coming forward, talking, sharing. My book is based on all the experience I've had working with women over years. I mean, I started in 1976 as a volunteer in graduate school at the Austin Rape Crisis Center in Texas. It was the first rape crisis center in Texas. We had all just read Susan Brown Miller, you know, it was like against our will. And we were all kind of like, oh, you know, kind of like an awakening. And we had the naive assumption that if we just educated everyone and that if men understood that it would stop. And the difficulty, I think, for women of my generation is looking back and realizing as we watch Washington and listen to people asking the same questions that we had to deal with in the 70s. I know in my book, part of it is one person who reports, a young woman who does report, and her whole experience, both police, district attorney, Title IX, and then another one who doesn't. And neither of the people in my book tell their parents. That's what that comment is on you. For me, a lot of young women do not want to tell their parents. Their parents will be devastated. So even though they're dealing with
trauma, they're trying to protect
their parents from the emotional devastation, and also because they feel that on somehow, not everyone, but many women will feel like they did something to put themselves in that position. Like, why did I do that? Why did I accept that drink?
Do you think that feeling of responsibility is coming from?
I think our entire culture puts the responsibility, it's women's responsibility, it's like to protect themselves, not men's responsibility to, intervene or to have social mores among themselves in which it's really inappropriate and bad to treat women that way.
Can we back up and talk a little bit more about the experience you bring to this topic? You're a therapist in Lawrence now, as I've mentioned, and you were also the first woman to work in the counseling center at Washburn back in 1978. Is that right? Before that, all the therapists at the counseling center on a college campus were men.
Well, it was not that big a university. Let's not put it on Washburn. But I was down in Texas. I'd never been in Kansas. But this job offer came through. And I thought I'd be here for like 3 years. And it was it was really like they had sort of discovered, oh, there's been a women's movement. We need one. It was the best job ever. I got to, there was free reign. It was like I could start assertiveness training groups, and we did a lot of things like back then we did a lot of things on rape prevention. As the women, if we just, you know, carried our shriek alarms, which I still have from the 70s, our shriek alarms, and put your keys in a certain way and be vigilant that you can
protect yourself. Yeah, I remember yourself.
Those illusions. It's this illusion of security and safety.
I got those instructions in the early 90s, and I remember, being warned against wearing a ponytail that could be grabbed. And...
Oh, we went through, we probably wrote those instructions in the 70s for you women in the 90s.
What kind of stories were you hearing? I mean, specifically around this issue of reporting or not from young women, 18, 19 years old back in 1978 and in the following years. Are they the same stories you're still hearing in Lawrence today, also a college town?
Sometimes it's different. The rape that we had, the way we imagined it and thought of it in the 70s, was far more the stranger danger. I mean, what you're protecting with a ponytail is not protecting the guy that you're sitting having a drink with at dinner. You know, it was a different kind of emotional response. Right now, what's happening is very, very different than my experience with my clients. It's much more involved with hookup culture. At the same time, I've sat in part of my research. I'm a researcher, so I mean, I spent 3 years and just in the immediate research and then 37 years before that. But I sat on rape trials.
Yeah, tell me about that. You went to rape trials over what period of time?
Over 2 years.
And observed in order to research this book?
Yes.
What did you learn? What did you see?
There were no convictions.
None?
No.
In 2 years?
No. There are no convictions. There will be convictions now for, again, what we would consider to be stranger rape, but also when it's accompanied by another crime. Like if someone is in a home break-in and they break in and they kidnap people and they rape, then it's like, oh, they were really raped. If it's a stranger danger thing. But if people have broken bones there has to be really visible signs that they were physically attacked. It has to be a really horrible physical attack in addition to a rape. If there's alcohol involved, the victim is more on trial.
Can you spell out a little bit what that means when you say the victim is on trial? How do you observe that? What is it that you see that makes you feel like it's the victim on trial?
The last trial, the few of them that I went to, the victim's on the stand for hours. She is grilled about, there's a big sign, the defense attorney had a power thing up on a whatchamacallit board, and it was rape or regret. That's in front of the jury the entire time. There was a point they went through it had a picture of the room where she was raped, and then asking her, and this is a year and a half later, go through now, where were your hands at this point? Well, where were your legs at this point? Well, when he was penetrating you and the other person was holding down your legs, there were two men. And every time she said, I can't remember, it was like, oh, as though that's... Or she'd say something and they'd say, well, is that physically possible? You know, it was constantly her. They dangled her thong underwear and said, is this what you were wearing? Now, on top of that, she'd had sweatpants and a T-shirt. It was not a provocative, by any means. But, and then so I'm waiting, because I'm still kind of, sometimes I feel like I'm not naive, but I'm still waiting for, like, okay, when the defendant gets on the stand and they're asking him and he can't remember, I'm waiting for him to get grilled. They just don't take the stand. They don't have to take the stand. So the only person that's being grilled over and over and over is the victim. And as a therapist, I have to really understand how re-traumatizing that can be. And it's not like that's every case, but then advise clients.
You know, can you help us understand what people are going through emotionally after something like this has happened and how that plays into what that experience would feel like, but also that decision about reporting or not?
So many young women are in the initial thing is shock. And my experience quite often is that it's not the victim in that period of time right after a rape that actually makes the decision to report. It's a friend. In other words, she turns to someone. She goes, I was just raped. And the friend goes, oh, my God, we have to call someone. And they call a rape crisis center, or they just, let's go to the ER. It's like that sometimes action is put into place, and it isn't really the victim's decision. So even that is a process where they might be in control.
Well, we're going to be getting to some of our calls in just a minute, but let me quickly introduce our second guest, because she will also be here to talk people who call in at 816-235-2888 with their stories about why they did or didn't report sexual assault. Victoria Pickering is the Director of Advocacy with MOXA. That's the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, Gina.
When you hear all the reasons not to report, which we've heard some of, like all the things that you're going to be up against if you do go through like legal proceedings. The question in my mind sometimes becomes not so much why wouldn't you report and more why would you?
I think that's a really great way to frame the discussion. So when we work with survivors of sexual violence, whether that's in a hospital setting or whether that's working with somebody over the 24-hour hotline, we try to present all of the potential options that an individual has in regards to reporting. So that could include reporting to law enforcement. If it's something that happened in an educational setting, it could be reporting to the school through a Title IX process. It could be reporting to an employer if there's a colleague involved, or it could be making a choice not to report at all. And when we have those discussions, we try and have an open, honest conversation about what the next steps in the process will be with every decision. So one of the things that I see in my work is that survivors of sexual violence, just like everyone else walking around on the street, has not been trained on what it means to be a victim of a crime, what it means to engage with the criminal justice system. Oftentimes we use language like, do you want to press charges, as if that is a choice that a survivor even has the right to make, which sadly they don't.
Wait, what do you mean by that?
So pressing charges in a criminal case is actually the decision of a prosecutor, not of a victim. A victim has the right to decide if they want to report. Just like if your home is broken into, you can call law enforcement. You can choose not to call law enforcement. And in those situations, rarely does somebody question someone's integrity when they choose not to. But that is really the choice of the survivor, is reporting or not reporting. The investigation is handled by law enforcement. And then the decision about pressing charges is made by a prosecutor, hopefully with discussion with the survivor about what they want to see happen and what they're comfortable with. But that is not the role that the survivor gets to play in that process. So a lot of the work we do at MOXA is talking to folks about what is the process really going to look like and helping folks have all the information they need so that they can make an informed decision. And if they choose to report, we always talk about making sure that it is focused on something that they see as being beneficial for their healing process.
Let's talk with some of our callers. We've got someone going simply by M with us on the line. Hi, M.
Good morning. I'm really happy that you have this show and this topic that you're discussing. And I was talking to your producer. I told them that, and I'm a male. As a child, I was sexually abused. And it took me 30 years before I told my parents. I eventually faced the person who was responsible. Now, I have 5 sisters, 7 daughters. And so as a parent, it was crucial that I taught my daughters that there were places, certain places, no one could touch you. And today,
our connection's a little rough. I'm going to get someone to respond to the first part of your comments, and then I'll bring you back on, hoping that we have a little better of a connection for the rest of it. So just hang tight. Can someone take this? First of all, that being a child, that is a particular set of circumstances.
Yes. And first of all, I want to say thank you for calling. And I'm so sorry that that happened to you. And thank you for your courage. I think it's absolutely a critical conversation that we start talking to young people at a very young age about the fact that their bodies belong to them and that they have a right to say what they're comfortable with and say what they're not comfortable with. So what Em is talking about teaching his children is part of what we do at MOXA as well in our education program, is talking to young people starting at kindergarten level about what it means for them to have bodily autonomy and what it means for them to be able to identify what is a touch that makes them feel unsafe or uncomfortable.
You know, I have been reading sort of within the Kansas City region tweets on the Why I Didn't Report hashtag, and also thinking about, obviously, Christine Blasey Ford's prepared remarks. And something she mentioned is that she was afraid she was going to get in trouble if she talked to her parents for being at a party where there was alcohol. And many of the tweets, children experiencing something like this, believe that there's some piece of the story they are going to get in trouble for. And that seems like such a recurring dynamic. How do you not just teach kids what is and isn't appropriate touch, but also make them feel safe coming to you, knowing that this is more important than any like minor misstep that they might have to confess along the way, that these two things are separate?
I would say the first step in that process is to have open, honest conversations with young people about this exact topic. So when we talk around the issue, we allow a lot of inference and we recognize that there are a lot of societal messages that young people are exposed to that contribute to them thinking that. Just like Susan said, people often blame themselves because our culture blames survivors. So we have to confront that head on and talk to young people and say, if you were drinking, if the person who's hurting you says you're going to get in trouble if you tell your mom or dad about this, that there are still safe adults that they can talk to, and that making sure that they are okay and making sure that they have access to safety is way more important than if they happen to be drinking at a party.
I think what is happening now in terms of the education and in the schools and through programs like MOXA, there's so much more. This simply didn't exist 30 years ago, 40 years. It didn't exist. I don't think 20 years ago there was nothing this frank or this open or this clear. So for me, that's a sense of a new development. I think the thing is that so many victims still, we're sort of incorporate into, it's like in our bones to feel responsible. And women are often just, you know, to please, and they don't question. I'll have work with so many women who just don't question. They'll feel a fear, a flight, you know, like a twinge in the back of their neck, like this might not be right. But you know, don't want to be impolite. don't want to say, oh no, I'm, you know, yeah.
We will be taking more of your calls at 816-235-2888 in just a minute on KCUR's Central Standard. We're talking about hashtag Why I Didn't Report, prompted by the discussion around Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, who's been accused of sexual assault, and the woman who's come forward with allegations decades later. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about why you did or didn't report an experience of sexual assault on the day of Christine Blasey Ford's testimony before a Senate committee. Her prepared remarks began with these words: "I am here today not because I want to be. I am terrified." This conversation gets at why that might be, not just for her, but for victims coming forward under a variety of circumstances. Our guests are Lawrence-based author and therapist Susan Krause and the director of advocacy at MOXA, Victoria Pickering. Hi again.
Hello.
Hi, Gina.
So we have been talking with some callers, and I want to get right back to them. But as this conversation takes over the news cycle, including local talk shows, do you have any quick recommendations for how people who have experienced this kind of assault take care of themselves?
I think for anybody, if there's anyone who has not reported and has not shared their experience, I think the absolute safest place to start is to go now to, like Moxa, to go to any place that's what they do, and they provide services, and there are support groups, and there's people who can validate and give you a sense of inclusion and take away any sense of shame or blame, self-blame that some women carry around. That would be the start, I don't care if it happened 60 years ago. Just go down, just call up and go down and walk in and start talking to the people who can begin the process of healing.
I would also say don't feel obligated to engage in conversations that you're not comfortable with. For some people, this is a theoretical or political conversation. For survivors, it's very personal. And self-care and making sure that you are okay is the most important thing.
Let's talk to Amanda calling us from Platte Woods. Hi, Amanda.
Good morning.
What do you want to share?
I found it interesting that your first commenter said that a lot of women or a lot of victims won't tell their parents because they don't want to put them through that or they feel shame. My experience with my parents is entirely different. I never told my mom didn't know until yesterday that I was raped 20 years ago. I knew they would blame me.
Wait, sorry, you knew what? I'm so sorry to ask you to repeat that, but you knew they were what?
I knew they would blame me for it. I knew that they would say it was my fault.
I'm so sorry, first of all, for what happened to you. Can you talk to us about the decision to tell them yesterday?
Well, I've been somewhat public with my friends over the last few years about this. And I made a post yesterday on Facebook saying why I didn't report. And at the time, I didn't report because I felt like, I didn't say no. I was scared to. Is it still rape? And it took me 20 years to figure out, yes, that is still sexual assault. And I made a post about it yesterday. My mom commented on it. And I told her, I didn't tell you guys because you would blame me. And her only response was, you know, that's not true.
Yeah, let's let our therapist jump in here. But yes, Amanda.
I'm a mom myself now of a five-year-old, and I plan to talk with him about it this weekend. It just crushes me to think that he might ever feel that way about me as a parent.
Your child, your own child, yeah.
I've moved past the violation myself, but I don't think I'll ever get past the lack of family support.
What you're describing right now is, I cannot tell you how almost every... I started and we were talking and people wanted to protect their parents, and that was one piece of it. And we're moving through this topic very quickly. But even in my book, the person doesn't tell her parents because exactly what you're saying. Because if I tell them, she was just saying, if I tell them, they'll ask me the same questions the police ask me.
How do we as parents give that message unknowingly to our children? I'm assuming it's unwittingly.
I think that we send that message not just as parents, but as community members when we have these conversations in a vacuum and don't remember that survivors are listening when we have these conversations and people who may
experience survivors.
Exactly. And so if somebody has heard a loved one say degrading things about a survivor who has come forward and then they experience violence, that's a really rational fear and a really normal response. And I'm so sorry that the caller had that experience.
Amanda, thank you so much for calling us.
Thank you.
And yeah, this is a difficult conversation, and I am really impressed that people are finding the bravery to share their stories in order to further this conversation. Let's talk to a caller who would like to go by the initial S in Leawood. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
All right. This is a tough conversation, but we're all powering through.
Well, there's a couple of things I'd like to say. One, I am half Chinese, half American. My parents split when I was young, and so I grew up with a tiger mom. And I was sexually assaulted over in Shanghai when I did a foreign exchange program. And when I came back early, I told my mom, and the first thing she said, she started crying with me, but she said, "Why did you do this to me? How could you do this to me?" of course, 5-10 minutes after crying, you know, she was very much so in tune with me, and she felt horrible, and she felt just as dirty as I did. But at the same time, you know, recently she was remodeling her house, and she was very stressed out picking out chandeliers and paint colors and all that fun stuff. So I was staying later with a friend, and one of the workers, who was construction workers, came over and attempted to sexually assault my friend and I, me when I was using the restroom. My friend has, you know, 2 kids and a husband, and she did not want to report it. She was scared. She didn't want her kids finding out, et cetera. So even though I was very, you know, hesitant to report it, I did it for the both of us and other victims to try and be strong for them. And I reported it to the detective, and he started, you know, doing what detectives do. And halfway through it, you know, I kind of just chickened out. I got very scared, and I still haven't done anything with the case, even though the detective asked me, what would you like to do? Do you want to press charges? You know, he can go to county jail. He can go to state jail. You know, I don't know what any of these things are, and so I haven't even replied to him or answered any of his calls. I'm terrified.
I'm sorry to prod, but when you say that you, quote, chickened out, are you able to tell me more about what it was that scared you?
Just going in front of the police officer, the detective, and being in a room where it was recorded and having to go over what I went through and remember all the details, and then knowing that I'm going to be on stand and I'm going to have to be, I don't want to say interviewed, but questioned. And, you know, the whole thing was, I just wanted to report this, and I wanted the person to be responsible, but, you know, I didn't want to have all of the responsibility of communicating, because I'm not strong enough emotionally.
Yes, thank you for this call. I'm going to get you some responses from our guests.
That's not chickening out. That's being pushed at the beginning to kind of move in one direction and feeling like, okay, this is what I should do. This is it has to be your personal decision. And a personal decision is, it's not chicken. It's like I'm making a decision in the best interest of my own mental health, my own emotional health, my family, and whether or not this is something that I'm going to keep going through. And the other piece that jumped out at me in what you're saying is, like, to county jail. What, there's no guarantees of any jail. I mean, that's not something you get. You can do your very best, and you can put a year into this, and you can be on the stand, and it won't come to a conviction. And it really has to be. And I'm not kind of discounting the. I think there's outstanding people now in law enforcement and district attorneys. Almost everybody I talked with, they want to prosecute. They want successful prosecutions, but they can't get them. There's almost a culture that says there has to be all of this evidence. I think CSI has helped.
Yeah, so my first thought in this process is that anytime somebody has to engage with the criminal justice system, it's a really scary process. And like Susan said, it should be a really personal decision. There's also people who can help in that process. We have advocates at MOXA who can go with people when they're meeting with law enforcement, when they go to court. And having a person there who can help navigate those very complex systems can take some of the burden off of a survivor. So I highly encourage folks who are considering their options to feel free to reach out. Call our 24-hour hotline, 816-531-0233, and talk to an advocate about how we can support you if you're interested in that process.
You know, we may have time for one more caller, but before we do that, Victoria, if there was one piece of advice you wish you could reach people with who don't come to MOXA for help, what would it be?
I guess less than a piece of advice, it would be just a statement. I believe you.
That seems both really profound and really simple. How do you think that the rest of our culture could send that message? The rest of us who, I mean, I am sitting behind a microphone. A lot of our listeners are not.
Yeah, I think it's such an incredibly powerful thing to let survivors know that the number one barrier that often hinders somebody from feeling safe coming forward, that fear of not being believed. If we take away that barrier, if we publicly, openly, actively tell survivors that we believe them and that we will support them regardless of what decision they make moving forward, we are going down the right path of changing the culture and creating a space that's safer for survivors. And that's I think, the absolute minimum that we can do to help this process.
Susan, any thoughts from you of like that piece of advice that you wish you could communicate to people who aren't coming into your practice, who aren't sitting one-on-one with you, but have experienced a lot of the things your clients have experienced?
I would support everything that was just said. But if you're really, there are people that really, they just don't know if they can say it out loud. And at that point, I'd say, you know, you can almost get a sense of community. I mean, I get so angry with that what's happening, but you can get almost a sense of community if you just Google something like, why women are not reporting, and then print out some articles and read them and realize you're not alone, and read some books about it because you're not alone. There's millions of us.
Susan Krause, Victoria Pickering, thanks so much. You can get this conversation later today at kcur.org if there's someone you'd like to share it with, and keep tweeting us. We are at KCURCST. I'm Gina Kaufman. KCUR's Central Standard continues with something entirely different when we return. Grant Buhman is a spindly 7-year-old with strawberry blonde hair. He's a healthy, happy kid. There's just one thing he has to watch out for.
My name is Grant and I'm allergic to peanuts.
He was diagnosed with a peanut allergy when he was 18 months old. Our intern, Sophia Gillespie, went to hang out with Grant in his kitchen.
So do you have any peanut products in your house that you know of?
Yes. Well, no.
As soon as they found out about Grant's allergy, his family scoured the pantry for peanut products. They got rid of them for good. They don't buy anything that could possibly contain peanuts. Anything even made in the same facility with peanuts is off the table. At 7, Grant is well-versed in reading food labels.
I just find labels and then I look through the ingredients, and then normally at the very bottom it says contains. And on this one, specifically, it says contains wheat, so I can have that.
Then what does it say underneath there?
Made in a facility that processes milk and soy, so I can have that.
At an age when most kids still lose gloves and homework, Grant manages to carry an epinephrine auto-injector with him everywhere he goes.
It's right here. We normally take an EpiPen wherever we go, and we just take out that EpiPen and just stab it in my leg.
That's something they would only do in a dire situation where Grant has accidentally ingested peanuts, despite all their precautions. Grant brings his own lunch to school every day.
What kind of things do you like to eat for lunch?
Lunchables. I also like to bring some yogurt, and I also like to have some mini hard salamis. Today I had a soy butter and jelly.
Soy butter is a peanut butter alternative. Since it doesn't have nuts, it's safe for Grant to eat. It may taste like peanut butter, but it costs a lot more, and that's something his parents have to consider.
We can't buy things that are manufactured in a plant that processes peanuts. So a lot of your generic junk food, we can't purchase it. We won't bring it into the home. And it really forced us to eat more fresh ingredients and bring more of the fresh vegetables and fruit to the table.
Do you find that to be more expensive?
It is.
How do you deal with that?
Your health is certainly worth it.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and now we're going to hear about life in the food allergy world, starting with a conversation about affordability. What do you do if your family can't afford these specialty products? In Kansas City, there is a food pantry stepping in to help, and the founder, Emily Brown, is here to tell us about it. Emily Brown, with us from the Food Equality Initiative, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Thank you for having us here today.
Talk to me about the need out there for something like this.
Well, when you have a diagnosis of food allergy, really at this point, the only way you manage it is by having the right foods, knowing how to read food labels, and how to prepare safe and healthy meals. Of course, emergency epinephrine is there in case you have an accidental exposure and it's severe and you need to use that. But the day-to-day management really is reading the food labels and having access to the right foods.
So then that access piece of it is what you deal with?
Correct. A lot of the specialty items can be difficult for families living in the inner city or even out in rural communities because those items are not on the shelf there.
So even if you could afford them, where would you go to get them?
Right. They may not be there. And then if they are there, there's that question, can you afford them?
What are the kinds of stories you hear when families come in about access?
Well, many of the clients that we serve, the families that we serve at the pantry, they have difficulty affording the food consistently. So they may be able to buy some items, but not enough, or, you know, not enough to make it through the month.
As food allergies become more common, do you think people have started viewing the need that exists differently, both just the need to be accommodated and then the need to have access to safe food? Because I understand that tonight you've got an event where you're helping release a new t-shirt from Raygun called with the slogan on it, Overachieving Immune System.
Yes. So we're really excited about the shirt because we think it helps people show a little bit of allergy pride, right? Because if you've got a food allergy, really it's your immune system is really overachieving. And so there's a little bit of humor in that. And we're excited about that. But really the point of selling the shirts is to help raise funds to make sure that we can stock the shelf and that every family that has these special dietary needs can have access to the foods that they need.
Well, so that sounds very lighthearted, this t-shirt about an overachieving immune system. But actually, I mean, I wonder if the existence of a resource like the food pantry you offer is a sign that greater understanding of the basic issues is improving, and now we can get into the nitty-gritty of life with food allergies, that we can have a t-shirt that, you know, turns a food allergy into something that isn't a source of like, oh, I'm so embarrassed to order in this restaurant, to suddenly like, yeah, I'm part of a posse.
Exactly. You're part of the food allergy posse.
But do you think that understanding is improving and that kind of, I don't know, evolution has taken place on some level?
Well, I certainly think that awareness of food allergies has grown even since the time that my children were diagnosed. And so for us, we've been living this lifestyle for about 4 years. And so I've seen more awareness, but we still have a long way to go.
When you talk about it as a lifestyle, we've heard some of what that means with our visit to meet Grant and his family. Are there details of the lifestyle that we haven't touched on that you think people who don't deal with this day-to-day should know about?
Well, I think people don't always understand just the kind of pervasiveness of dealing with a food allergy and kind of the impact on the quality of life. I mean, your visit to Grant's house, he explained how to read the labels and, you know, he seems to be managing really well, and that's great. But sometimes kids and individuals living with food allergies, it can be isolating. And it just, you're reminded every time you sit at the table that you can't have something. And we tend to celebrate with food in our society. So food is everywhere, you know, for the holiday, the birthday, you know, celebrations at work and school. They're pervasive. And so,
and you're the person who can't participate then sometimes.
Right. And that can be challenging.
Well, let's bring in some other guests to get more of a picture of how life with food allergies and particularly severe food allergies might be changing. Grace Guthrie has a food allergy and Jay Portnoy, is an immunologist at Children's Mercy. Hi, Grace.
Hello.
Hi, Jay.
Hi there.
So, Jay, first of all, what would your observations be about whether something is or isn't changing in the food allergy world and the culture around it?
The prevalence of food allergy has just exploded in the last few years. We're seeing a lot more food allergy than we used to see. But not only that, parents And children are becoming terrified of the fact that they have food allergy, tremendous amounts of anxiety. So I spend a lot of time working with families that have that problem. So we're seeing a lot of patients who have food allergy. About 1.5% of the population will have a peanut allergy. It can be as high as 3 to 6% for milk, egg, wheat, and soy. And that prevalence has been increasing over the last few years.
Why do you think fear is increasing? It seems like the risks for an individual who's just been diagnosed haven't changed. What do you attribute that to?
I think there's just this widespread anxiety that our population has to just about everything. Everything in the world is going to cause harm to you, and food is another thing. Usually you think of food as something that's nourishing and helpful, and here something you ate is causing you to have a severe reaction. Now, that can really cause a great deal of fear. Who would have expected that that would happen?
I'm interested in understanding a little bit more about how you diagnose. Has that changed? Has that gotten easier?
Well, we have a lot more understanding about how to diagnose food allergy. First of all, food allergy is an immune response to things that you eat. People who have food allergy make this antibody called IgE, and that's called sensitization. What's puzzling, though, is that not everybody who has this IgE antibody is allergic to the foods that their IgE is directed to. Some people have an elevated IgE, and they can eat the food and not have a problem. That was always a puzzle. More recently, we've discover that food is not a single thing. It's a whole bunch of different proteins. Some of them tend to cause allergic reactions, others don't. So the tests that we do need to be broken down into those individual components. So we do that kind of testing now and can identify specific proteins that if you're sensitized, you're more likely to have an allergic reaction to. The thing I would point out is that if you have an elevated blood test or skin test to a food, it doesn't necessarily mean you're allergic to it. But if you have had an allergic reaction to it and an elevated IgE, then you're at increased risk of having anaphylaxis, the severe allergic reaction, and that's when families really need to pay attention to what they eat.
Grace, as someone who has a food allergy, how are you hearing this conversation? I mean, first of all, how old are you now, and how old are you when you got your diagnosis?
So now I'm 23, and I was diagnosed, I believe, when I was 2. It was when I was at daycare. I put some on my face, and my face just swelled up. So we've known for most of my life that I was allergic to peanuts. And I can definitely understand the fear that that we were talking about. I think for me, when I was little, a lot of the fear came from just not knowing why foods would, you know, cause a severe reaction. All I knew was that peanuts would make me really sick, and I didn't know why, and no one knew why, and it didn't seem to happen to anyone else. So I was the only one who really had this problem, and I think that's where all the fear for me came from.
It seems like these allergies are becoming more common. I mean, first of all, Dr. Portnoy, is that accurate or is that just a perception?
No, that's true. The prevalence of peanut allergy has more than doubled in the last 10 years.
So, Grace, I mean, as you see it becoming more common, do you feel less of that sense of this is a weird thing that happens and it only happens to me?
No, I mean, now that I've gotten older and I've learned more about food allergies, I definitely understand more, and a lot of the fear has, you know, been assuaged. I'm not as afraid as I used to be. However, I understand why a smaller child might be, and so whenever I meet a child who has a food allergy, and if they ever ask me questions about it, I try to be really reassuring and, you know, say, you can manage this. This is something you'll have to live with, but there are plenty of things you can do to prevent a reaction. And one upside to having more allergies is there's a lot better labeling on foods. So it is easier to avoid allergens, I think.
You know, we have a tweet from a listener who is sharing with us that they've been dealing in their family with a food allergy for about 15 or 16 years. And something we haven't talked about yet, they have to watch out for not just foods, but like shampoos and other products that might contain certain ingredients like almonds. Do you have that experience that it goes beyond food, that you're just having to read labels on everything?
I don't personally read labels on things other than food. I do have to be careful if there are food particles in a room. So if I'm not necessarily eating something, but for example, if I was at a party and they had a Sunday bar and they had an open cup of peanuts, if I was too close to the peanuts or if people were touching things and touching the peanuts, then I could have reactions. So while no, I don't necessarily read soaps or shampoos or anything, there is more to consider than just the, you know, ingestion of peanuts.
What do you do at a party, for example, if there's something clearly in the environment that could be hazardous to you?
It does depend on how many allergens or, you know, how many peanuts there are. If there's just one small bowl in the corner, I might not worry so much about it, but I have left parties before because I just didn't feel comfortable being there or asked friends to, you know, step outside with me for a little while. So I have had to, you know, remove myself from certain situations just to be safe.
Emily, this gets back to what you were saying about us celebrating around food and the isolation that can come with having a food allergy. And that is, honestly, I hadn't considered isolation as something that people might experience from a food allergy.
Right. Well, we're several years in our journey, and I feel like, you know, when you're first diagnosed, there's really a lot of anxiety, which Dr. Portnoy mentioned. But I know for us, when we were first diagnosed, and, you know, we used to go to church potluck every week, and then that didn't really seem to be a really safe place because you don't know what's in all of the food. And
you don't want to interrogate every community member about their recipe.
Exactly. So that kind of really became a difficult place for us to go. And even when you prepare your own food and bring it there, it's not the same, especially with small children who are looking at all of the kids run around with their cookies and this and that and wondering why they can't have that. And
yeah, having to say, that's not for you. That's
right.
Just for everyone else.
Right. And even if you've brought them a safe cookie, it's still very difficult sometimes for small children to understand. I'll never forget, you know, my oldest, she's 6 now, but when she was 3, we went to our first birthday party. And you know, I called the other mom and said, what are you preparing so I could bring something safe and alternative? And so they were having pizza and cake. And so I made safe pizza and safe cake. But we got there and then they served ice cream. And at the time, my daughter still had a dairy allergy. And so that was just, you know, I couldn't prepare for it.
Dr. Poynton, do you help parents navigate this stuff just from the outset, or do you let parents kind of go on their own journeys with things and come to you with the questions? Like, do you prepare them for situations like, you know, potlucks might be difficult. Your kid might want things and you're going to have to tell them no when everyone else has it. And or is that just sort of, that's more of a parenting question. But it seems like as someone who sees patient after patient, you might have guidance.
Yeah, we spend a lot of time with education of our families. One of the things we do is we try to dispel a lot of the myths that are out there about food allergy. For example, in most cases, you really have to eat the food to have an allergic reaction. Just being around food and smelling it is not going to cause anaphylaxis. What most people don't realize is that peanut allergen is ubiquitous in the environment. It's everywhere. Your house dust is loaded with peanut allergen.
Even if there are no peanuts in your house?
Even if there's no peanuts. We've gone into houses with peanut allergic people who swear that there's no peanut anywhere and their dust is loaded with peanut.
So, why? That's so weird.
We don't know where it comes from, but it's everywhere. And that's how you get sensitized to the peanut before you've ever eaten it. So just being around peanut is not going to cause anaphylaxis. You have to actually eat it to have a reaction.
What do you think about a t-shirt that says overachieving immune system?
Sounds great to me.
Well, the release party for that t-shirt is at Ray Gun in the Crossroads from 5 to 7 tonight. And our time is up for this conversation. But Grace Guthrie, Jay Portnoy, Emily Brown, thank you all so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will have a link to the info on the food pantry for people with food allergies when we put this conversation up at kcur.org/centralstandard. It'll be there later today. That's a wrap for today's show. You can talk to us on Twitter about anything we have discussed or should discuss. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at Gina KCUR. Tomorrow, it's a food show. We're talking about the sauces of Kansas City, legendary sauces with, like, cult followings and lesser known sauces you will want to try. That's tomorrow at 10, so tune in. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Kathleen Pointer, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.